"I've spoken to Dr. Bandara about it," Desaram said, inching his chair closer to the shade of the great pool umbrella. "He is confident the university will make a space available for you to hold your press conference. Indeed, he says it would be an honor for the school."
Ranjit said uncomfortably, "What would I say?"
"You'll tell them what you did," Desaram answered, leaving out, of course, all the specifics that Dr. Bandara feels must be kept secure. He set his cup down and smiled at Mevrouw Voorhoofd. "No, no more tea, thank you. I need to get back to the office, and I'll find my way out."
Mevrouw Voorhoofd let him shake her hand, but didn't protest as he left.
"Actually," she observed to Ranjit and Myra, "that sounds like an excellent idea. I'd love to hear that talk."
Then, turning to Myra, she said, "Dear, do you remember the room we used to put you to sleep in when your parents were going to be really late? It's still there, right next to Ranjit's, if you'd like to use it from time to time, or as often as you like. It's yours."
So when he went to sleep that night, Ranjit had to count that a good day. He had very little experience in public speaking, and that worried him a bit, but right there was Myra's head on the pillow next to his own, and all in all, things seemed to be going very well for him, at last. The auditorium that the university donated for Ranjit's press conference was quite big, and needed to be. Every one of its 4,350 seats was filled, and not just with newspeople. There were several hundred of those, but it seemed half of Sri Lanka had decided it wanted to be there as well. Besides the lucky 4,350, an additional 1,000 nearly watched on closed-circuit television in another campus hall, leaving quite a few extremely important, or so self-described, other people consumed with indignation over having to watch the event on, broadcast television. To Ranjit Subramanian, peering out at them through a peephole in the curtain, they looked like a great many people. It wasn't just the number of the human beings in the room, either. It was the particular human beings they were. The president of Sri Lanka was seated in the front row. Two or three possible candidates for the next election were there, and so was the Voorhoofd family, and, believe it or not, so was Ranjit's old math professor, not having the grace even to look as embarrassed as he should have felt, but instead smiling and nodding to everyone in a less favored seat than his. As the curtain began to rise, the man sitting in the armchair next to Ranjit's gave him a reassuring look. "You'll be fine," said the august Dr. Dattusena Bandara, unexpectedly having flown in from his hush-hush UN job just to introduce Ranjit. "I wish Gamini could have been here, and so does he, but he's busy recruiting in Nepal," he added. And then the curtain was up and the lights were on him, and, without explaining just what it was that Gamini had to go to Nepal to recruit, Dr. Bandara moved to the lectern. And then, sooner thereafter than Ranjit would have imagined possible, it was he who was at the lectern, and every pair of hands in that hall began to clap. Ranjit waited patiently for the sound to stop. When it didn't seem to be stopping, he cleared his throat. "Thank you," he said. "Thank you all." And then, as it abated only slightly, he began. "The man who presented this problem to me, well, to the world, was named Fermat, an advocate or lawyer in France a few centuries ago." By the time he got to the famous jotting in the margin of a page of Diophantus, the applause had subsided, and the audience was intent. They weren't quiet throughout the talk. They laughed when he commented that a lot of trouble could have been saved if the book Fermat had been reading had had larger margins. And they applauded again, though not in quite as unruly a fashion, as he described each step in his growing comprehension of what Fermat had been talking about. Then, when he described Sophie Germain's work, and how that turned out to be the key at last, they applauded a lot, and kept on doing so at every opportunity until Ranjit reached the moment when he had become pretty sure, or at least pretty nearly sure, that he had by God actually completed a defensible proof of Fermat's last theorem. He stopped, smiled, and shook his head at them.
Do you have any idea how hard it is to memorize a 5-page mathematical proof? He asked. I didn't have anything to write with, you see. I couldn't write it out. All I could do was go over it over and over again, repeating each little step, I don't know, hundreds of times or thousands. And then when I was rescued, all I could think of was getting to a computer and getting it all down at once. And I did, Ranjit finished, and let them clap the skin off their silly hands at that until they got tired of it, which took a long time, until he managed to cut in again, to say, And so Gamini Bandara, my oldest and dearest friend, is one of the people I have to thank, and so is his father, Dr. Datusena Bandara. He gestured toward the older man, who politely accepted his share of the applause. And there are two other persons I owe. One is my late father, Ganesh Subramanian, of the Tirukonaswaram temple in Trincomalee. The other person is hiding backstage here, but she is the one who first suggested to me that the clue to finding out what Fermat had discovered lay in looking at the mathematical procedures known to have been in use at around that time, and trying to figure out what other procedures Fermat might have deduced from them. I don't know what I might have done without her, and I don't intend to take that chance again. So come out here, Dr. Myra de Souza, and take my hand. Which she did, and though Ranjit was still speaking when she appeared, it was hard to make out just what he was saying. Myra got easily the biggest hand of anyone other than Ranjit himself, perhaps because the audience could read what was written all over his face when he spoke of her, perhaps only because she was definitely the best looking. Ranjit might have let her applause go on forever, but Myra was shaking her head. Thank you, she called, but let's hear the rest of what Ranjit has to say. She stepped back and sat down in Ranjit's own chair to listen. He turned back to the crowd. That's the end of what I wanted to say, he informed them. But I promised I would take a few questions. And then it was over, and he had successfully ducked all the questions about where he had been jailed and why. They were back in the Vorholst residence, along with a pared-to-the-bone residue of guests from the university hall. That included nearly all of the first two rows of the auditorium and a scattering of others, as well as a hired-for-the-occasion staff of servants to pass around the drinks and snacks. That was so the actual Vorholst household staff, each one of whom felt personally responsible for some part of the event, could attend as guests. Ranjit and Myra sat side by side, holding hands, and quite remarkably happy to be there. All of the guests were just as happy, so that the champagne the hired staff was passing out was very nearly superfluous. Dr. Bandara, of course, was already on his way back to New York in his own BAB 2200, but before he'd left, he had taken Ranjit aside for a few words. "You'll be wanting a job, of course," he began, and Ranjit nodded. "Gamini said something about going to work with him," Ranjit said. Datusena Bandara said, "And I hope that will happen, but I'm afraid not right away. Meanwhile, I understand the university is prepared to offer you a faculty position, teaching a few advanced classes and doing your own research, if you wish." "But I'm not a professor. I haven't even graduated," Dr. Bandara said patiently. "A professor is just a person the university has hired in that grade. And don't worry about degrees you may lack. I expect people will be offering you all the degrees you could wish for." All of this, naturally, Ranjit passed on to Myra, but Beatrix Vorholst, sitting on the other side of her, was looking dubious. "You know," she said, "I'm not sure you even need a job. Look at these." She held up a sheaf of printouts, vetted by her personal secretary, who was now supplemented by an assistant just to handle the traffic Ranjit was generating. "People want you to come and speak to them, or to be interviewed, or just to say that you drink their beer or wear their shirts, and they're willing to pay for it. If you'll wear their track shoes, these people will give you a good many American dollars, and if you'll let them interview you, 60 minutes will pay too.
Harvard University will pay you to come and talk to them. They don't say how much, but I understand they're rich.
Whoa, said Myra, laughing. Let the poor man catch his breath.
But the secretary screener was waving another piece of paper just off the printer at Mevrouw, who glanced at it, bit her lip, and said, Well, this one isn't about money, but I think you'll want to see it, Ranjit. And you too, Myra.
Me? Asked Myra. Why me?
But when it had been passed to Ranjit, who looked thunderstruck but handed it over to her, Myra quickly understood why. The note was from the old monk at his father's former temple, and what it said was,
Your father would be even more proud of you and as delighted as we all are that you are going to marry. Please don't delay too long. You don't want to wait until the unlucky months of Ashad, Bhadrapad, or Shunya. And of course, please, not on a Tuesday or a Saturday.
Myra looked up at Ranjit, who was staring in confusion at her.
Did I say anything about getting married? He asked.
This brought about a faint blush.
Well, you did say some nice things about me, she admitted.
I have no recollection of saying anything like that, he said. Must have been my subconscious.
And, taking a deep breath, he said,
Which proves that my subconscious is smarter than I am.
So what about it, Myra? Will you?
Of course I will, she said,
as though that had been the dumbest question she had ever heard. And that was that. Later, when the two of them played news clips of the speech, out of curiosity, they found that what he had said was simply the obvious truism that he could not imagine spending the rest of his life without her. But that was enough. And anyway, by then they were already thoroughly married. Was everything perfect for the loving pair? Well, pretty close. The one big question that had to be settled was not about whether they should get married, because there wasn't the slightest doubt about that, or even when, because the answer to that was as soon as could be. The real questions were where and by whom. For a time it looked like that was easily answered, too, because the Vorholsts and the Bandaras and the de Souzas among them had access to every church in the city of Colombo, not to mention every registrar's office, and were well along the process of eliminating the less attractive of them when Myra noticed the faraway look in Ranjit's eyes. When she asked, he shrugged it off.
Nothing, really, he said.
No, nothing at all. But since Myra did not give up easily, at last he relented and showed her yet another text from the old monk.
Your father would have been so happy to see you marry in his temple.
Myra read it twice, and then smiled. What the hell, she said. I don't think the Presbytery of Ceylon is going to care. I'll tell everybody. And, of course, everybody understood at once what Ranjit wanted was what Myra would enforce. And so it was. If there was a little disappointment in some circles in Colombo, there was wild delight among others in Trincomalee. The old monk quickly understood that it would have to be a stripped-down ceremony. He wistfully considered what a wonderful palikalitalipu they could have had for the bride, if they could have had them at all, and how the groom's Janavasanam arrival at the temple would have been decorated with the finest fruits and flowers. Well, that would have pretty nearly amounted to a full-scale parade, wouldn't it? And anything like that would have attracted vast attention just when the couple wanted to be ignored. So no palikalitalipu and no Janavasanam, though the monk did make sure that the bride's party carried the requisite supply of paraputenga and other sweetmeats to give to the groom. The good part of the stripped-downness of the wedding was that it could all be done quite quickly, for which reason it was less than a week before the bride and groom were in Trincomalee, well, in hiding in Trincomalee, to be exact, because they tried to avoid showing their instantly recognizable faces in public. For that reason there were few people at the ceremony, as Ranjit spoke the words the old monk had written out for him, and Myra allowed the monk to tie around her wrist the holy thread that would ward off evil with the endless flowers all over the room and the unending blare of the Nathaswaram horns and the Melam drums. Then it was all over, and the two of them, now indissolubly wed, got back into their police car for the long ride back to the Vorhulst estate.
"Long life!" called the monks as they left,
and indeed Ranjit and Myra felt confident that that was what lay ahead of them. However, other persons, farther away, had quite different expectations. Those persons included the 1.5s, the designated assassins for the Grand Galactics. They were executing their order to clean up the mess on Planet 3 of that trivial yellow star, and their armada was progressing on its flight. Since their vessels were material, they could not go faster than light speed. There would be many years of transit time, followed by a few days of actual extermination, after which the newlyweds and every other human being anywhere would be dead. It might not be a very long life, after all. Chapter 20. Marriage. Now that he was everything that he had dared to dream of being, namely free, famous, and married to Myra de Souza, it seemed to Ranjit that his personal world just kept getting better and better. There was, however, a larger perspective that kept intruding itself on his private musings, and in many ways that wasn't good at all. Take the situation in North Korea, for instance. First off, there seemed to have been a regime change. Blustery, luxury-loving Kim Jong-il was gone. In some ways, that was almost a pity. Kim might have been a nut, but he had been the kind of nut that had always stopped just short of an actual large-scale attack on his neighbors. Now there was this new guy. He was always referred to as the adorable leader. If he had a proper name, it seemed to be too precious to share with the decadent West. But if the adorable leader's identity was secret, what he did was all too public. Their latest generation of nuclear rockets, the adorable leader's generals claimed, could easily cross the northern stretches of the Pacific Ocean. This meant that they could strike actual United States of America soil, at least Alaska, perhaps even the northern corner of Washington State. What's more, the generals boasted, the new rockets were definitely reliable. This talk made all of their neighbors increasingly nervous. Those that didn't already have their own nuclear stocks were under increasing pressure to acquire them. Nor was the rest of the world much better off. In Africa, the continent had backslid to some of the worst days of the 20th century. Once again, they were seeing the armies of boy soldiers, some of them barely into their teens, drafted when their families were murdered, and fighting for stocks of illicit diamonds and even less licit ivory. It was discouraging. There was, though, one thing that did trouble Ranjit when he let himself think of it, and it came up when Mevrouw Beatrix Vorhulst looked in on a conversation with Lawyer de Saram to ask, "What would anyone like for dinner?" It was the same question that someone had to ask every morning, but this time it got a different reception. Myra turned to look inquiringly at Ranjit, who cocked an eyebrow at her, sighed, and spoke to their hostess. "That's something we've been talking about, Aunt B. We think you'd probably like to have your house back." It was the first time Ranjit had ever seen Beatrix Vorhulst look indignant. "Dear boy, not at all. We're glad to have you stay here as long as you like. Your family, you know. We like having you here, and we're honored, besides, and—" But Disaram, having studied Myra's face, was shaking his head. "Perhaps we've missed the point, Mevrouw," he said. "They're married. They want their own home, not a piece of yours, and they're absolutely right about it. Let's all have another cup of tea and consider the options. And as to a place for the two of you to live, you already have one, Ranjit. What used to be your father's home in Trincomalee is now yours, you know." Ranjit turned to examine Myra's face. The expression on it was very much what he had been expecting. "I don't think Myra wants to live in Trinco," he reported sorrowfully to the group.
but she was already shaking her head.
Trinco's beautiful, she said. I'd love to have a place there, but...
She didn't finish.
What then? Disarim asked, puzzled.
Ranjit answered for her. It was a very nice house for one elderly man, he said, but for us, that is, for a couple who are probably going to want washing machines, dishwashers, all sorts of appliances that my father had no reason to bother with. Well, what do you say, Myra? Do you want to start making changes in my father's house? She took a deep breath, but managed to compress her reply to one word.
Yes.
Of course you do, he said. You wouldn't rather tear it down and start over from scratch? No? All right, then the first thing we do is get Suraj to find us an architect who can make floor plans of what we've got to work with. He knows every Tamil in Trinco, and we invite him here with the plans, and you and he start creating. With, he added, me available for creative inputs any time I'm asked.
Meanwhile, Myra, you and I move our bodies into a hotel. How does that sound?
Mevrouw was frowning more deeply than Ranjit had ever seen her.
There's no reason for that, she declared. We're perfectly comfortable with you here until the place in Trincomalee is ready for you.
Ranjit looked at his wife, then spread his hands.
All right, but I do have another suggestion. Myra, love, didn't I once hear you say something about a honeymoon?
Myra looked surprised.
No, you haven't.
I admit I think a honeymoon would be grand, but I haven't said a single word about it.
Not since we were married, Ranjit agreed. But I remember exactly what you said to me right in this room a few years ago. You told me about all the wonderful parts of Lanka that I'd never visited. So let's go visit them, Myra, while everybody's getting the rest of our lives ready for us.
The best place to start was the easiest, Myra declared. So the first place they tried was the turtle hatchery in Kozgoda, because Myra had loved it as a child, and mostly because it was close enough for practice. Then Kandy, the island's grand old city. But a week later, when they had done them both and were back in the Vorholst house, and the staff wanted to know how they'd liked it, their responses were tepid. They had been recognized in Kozgoda, and small crowds had followed them about all day. Kandy had been worse. The local police had taken them around the town in a police car. They had seen everything, but hadn't once been allowed to wander at will. Over the dinner table, Beatrix Vorholst listened sympathetically as Ranjit explained that it was nice to be driven around, but they really would have liked to mingle with the crowds. She sighed.
I don't know if that can happen, she said. You're the best sight the people have for sightseeing purposes. You see, the trouble is that we're a bit short on world-famous celebrities here in Lanka. You're about all we've got.
Myra disagreed.
Not really. There's the writer.
Well, yes, but he hardly ever comes out of his house. Anyway, it's not the same. If we were somewhere thick with movie stars and all kinds of famous people, Los Angeles, for instance, or London, you two could just put on some dark glasses and you'd hardly be noticed.
And then her expression changed. She said,
Well, come to think of it, why not?
And when everyone was looking at her, she explained,
You've got all these invitations from all over the world, Ranjit. Why not accept a few?
Ranjit blinked at her, then turned to Myra.
What do you think? Should we try to have a real honeymoon? Europe, America, whatever you like?
She glanced at him, then around the table thoughtfully. She finally said,
I think that would be wonderful, Ranjit.
If we're going to do it, let's do it soon.
He gave her a curious look, but turned at once to questioning about what specific invitations were available. It wasn't until they were heading to bed that he thought to ask her,
You do want to do this, don't you? Because if you don't want to...
She laid a finger across his lips, and then, unexpectedly, followed with a kiss.
It's just that I think if we're going to do long-distance traveling, it might be better to do it soon. Might be a little more difficult later on.
I wasn't going to tell you until the doctor confirmed it, but I won't see her until Friday. The thing is, I'm pretty sure I'm pregnant.
Chapter 21 Honeymoon, Part 2 While Myra and Ranjit were making their way to London, a trip as long and wearing as Gamini had described it years before, the world was going on its own way, which was, of course, the way of death and destruction. They had booked their flight the long way around, by way of Mumbai, so Ranjit could get a quick look at the city. But their plane was 40 minutes late because of circling before being allowed to land. Artillery fighting had broken out again in the Vale of Kashmir. No one knew what underground Pakistani agents might be planning to do to targets in India's heartland. So the couple spent their whole time in the old city in their hotel room, watching television. That didn't have much good news either. Units of the adorable leader's North Korean army, no longer limiting themselves to creating incidents along the border with South Korea, had plucked up the courage to have a few incidents with the country that fed it, the one that was pretty nearly its only real friend in the world, the People's Republic of China. What they were up to, no one seemed able to guess, but 4 separate incursions, no more than a dozen or so troops each, crossed into PRC territory, where there was nothing but hills and rocks, and set up camp. Myra and Ranjit were 3 hours later boarding their London plane, too, but by the time they were airborne, skirting Pakistan's shoreline en route to Heathrow in England, the Kashmir fighting had died down, and the North Korean army had turned around and gone back to its barracks, and no one could figure out what they had been up to in the first place. And then there they were, in London. It did not disappoint, exactly. The great sights of the city were as fascinating to Ranjit as they had been to millions of visitors for hundreds of years. All of them, huge old St. Paul's, the Tower of London, the Houses of Parliament, Westminster Abbey, all the famous ones that every tourist had to see, and a fair number of sights that were not really famous at all, but were of particular interest to Ranjit, like the London School of Economics, and a certain superb maisonette a few squares away on Arundel Street, because both had once been inhabited by Gamini Bandara at a time when Ranjit himself had had no hope of ever visiting them. When Myra persuaded him to take an excursion to Kew Gardens, he really loved the vast greenhouses. He loved all the great and famous structures of the city, almost without exception. What he did not love in the least, however, was all the open and unroofed spaces that lay between them, the spaces that he had to traverse in order to get from one to another, and which were, without exception in this month of November, terribly, unbearably cold. This soul-searing experience was one that Ranjit had never before encountered in all of his life. Oh, perhaps he had suffered a brief chill, maybe at the tip of Swami Rock when the winds were strong, or when he was just coming out of a plunge in the surf in the early, early morning. Not like this. Not when it was so cold that the sparse snows of the week before, and even the ones of the week before that, still left their blackened remains on the margins of parking lots and the edges of lawns, because it had never warmed up enough since to finish melting them away. Still, London's shops were full of garments designed to keep the coldest visitor toasty, or anyway somewhat warm. Thermal underwear, gloves, and a fur-collared topcoat made the London streets bearable to Ranjit, while the first mink coat of her life improved things for Myra. Then they met Sir Tariq. It was he, on behalf of the Royal Mathematical Society, who had invited Ranjit to become a member, and to come to London to tell them about his feat, and had produced a foundation that paid their expenses. Sir Tariq al-Diwani turned out to be a plump, elderly man with unruly Albert Einstein hair, a kindly heart, and no trace of any accent but the purest Oxcam.
"Well," he explained when pressed, "I'm fourth-generation London, after all."
And when he found that Ranjit was freezing most of the time, he struck his forehead.
"Oh, blast," he said. "I let them give you posh instead of comfort. I'll have you moved."
What they were moved to was a brand-shiny new but not particularly fashionable hotel in South Kensington.
which puzzled Myra a bit until she had a talk with the concierge and, grinning, reported to Ranjit that Sir Tariq had chosen this particular hotel because, A, it was convenient to some of the city's best museums, if that should interest them while they were there, and, B, it was frequently occupied by Arab oil sheiks and their large retinues, an entire floor or two at a time. The importance of that was that what oil sheiks hated most, even more than Ranjit did, was being cold, not just in their private rooms, but in a hotel's lobbies, fire stairs, and even elevators as well. And what the owners of the hotel hated even more than that was to fail to give those free-spending Arabs every last thing they might desire. Though not himself a free-spending oil sheik, Ranjit was happy to receive the fallout from their spending. Over the next couple of months, his mood improved visibly, improved enough indeed for him to take a shot at that other reason for the particular hotel they were in, its proximity to Museum Row. The Natural History Museum, though drafty, was a delight, inspiring Ranjit to agree to the cross-town odyssey to the Great British Museum itself, back in Gamini's part of town, even grander, if even draftier, and making him agree that, yes, cold countries might after all have some advantages over the hot ones. It wasn't all tourism. The lecture for the Royal Mathematical Society took some thought, though actually what Ranjit said in London was pretty much what he had said at the press conference in Colombo. Two magazines had urgently requested a visit, Nature, because they were the ones who had published his paper, and New Scientist, because, they promised, they would take him to the best pub on their side of the Thames. And there were a couple of press conferences, too, set up at long range by Disaram in Colombo. And even so, with their pictures in print on every newsstand and occasionally on the telly as well, Myra persuaded Ranjit to put his thermal underwear to the test by standing outside Buckingham Palace one evening to observe the changing of the guard. When they were back in their hotel, and Ranjit had to admit none of his parts seemed to be at all frostbitten from the ordeal, he also pointed out that of all the cameras held by their fellow tourists, every last one had been pointed at the guards and not one at them. "So it's true," he said. "We can move around London all we like, and no one pays any attention to us at all. I'd really like this place if they'd just move it 1,000 kilometers or so south." Well, they wouldn't do that. So after a few hours of bundling up to get from the hotel lobby to a taxi, and from the taxi to some other lobby somewhere else, Ranjit gave up. He took Sir Tariq aside. Then he got on the phone with Disaram in Colombo, and then, grinning, reported to Myra, "We're going to America. It's what they call the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and next month they're having their annual convention, and Disaram has it all worked out. Oh, we're not through here, Myra. Not permanently. We'll do everything there is to do here, but not until the weather's a little warmer." So they were booked, first class, another of those generous foundations, to leave on the American Delta flight to New York City, Kennedy, at 2 p.m. that afternoon. Which they did, though with many sincere protestations of thanks to Sir Tariq, and by 2:20 they were leaving England behind and approaching the eastern coast of Ireland. Ranjit was all solicitude. "I haven't rushed you too much, have I? You're not—" The whoopsing gesture he made at his mouth elucidated the question for Myra, who laughed. She held up her glass for an orange juice refill from the attendant, who was quick to oblige. "I'm fine," she said. "And yes, you and I can come back to England when it's nice and warm, say June. But are you sure you're doing the right thing now, going to America?" Ranjit finished spreading the clotted cream and strawberry preserves on his scone and popped the product into his mouth. "Of course I am," he told her, chewing. "I check the New York weather reports for myself. Right now they've got a low of 9, looking to a high for the day of 18. I've been colder than that in Trinco." Uncertain whether to laugh or cry, Myra set down her glass. "Oh, my darling," she said, "you've never been in America, have you?" Suddenly worried, Ranjit turned to face her. "What do you mean?" She reached out to stroke his hand. Just that you haven't noticed that they're pretty old-fashioned there in some ways. The way they still use miles instead of kilometers, for instance. And, I hope this won't upset you, the way they cling to the Fahrenheit thermometer scale instead of going to Celsius along with the rest of the world.
Chapter 22 The New World. Apart from the great thermal disappointment that the climate of New York represented for Ranjit, the news that kept coming over their hotel suite's large supply of TV sets was even more disheartening than usual. For example, South America had been relatively quiet war-wise for some time. No longer. Now, as one of their American hosts explained it to Myra and Ranjit, what had changed was the fact that the United States had revised most drug crimes down from felonies to, at most, misdemeanors. That had decriminalized nearly all the stock in trade of the Colombian drug merchants. That change in the laws made it possible for any American addict to get what he needed for his habit cheap and without gangster intervention at any local pharmacy, thus effectively putting the gangsters out of business. It also made it pointless for any neighborhood pusher to hand out free samples to 12-year-olds. That would no longer ensure him a supply of addicted customers for the future, since none of those future customers, if there were any, would be buying from him anyway. And so each year the census of American addicts slowly dwindled as the oldest ones died or went dry, and few new ones came along as replacements. But that was only the good part of drug decriminalization. There was a bad part as well. The bad part, or the worst of the bad parts, was that the drug cartels, deprived of the profits from their coca plantations, began to look longingly at the equally addictive stuff that was being exported by their neighbors in Venezuela. Why, there was even more money in oil than there ever had been in drugs. And so armed parties from the Colombian drug citadels were infiltrating the oil fields of their neighbor. The relatively small, and often quite purchasable, Venezuelan army was putting up a show of resistance, sometimes, but the powerful motivation was all on the Colombian side, and so were almost all the victories. All this, of course, in addition to the latest list of vicious little escapades from the adorable leaders North Korea, and in addition to the renewal of violence in the irreconcilable fragments of what had once been Yugoslavia, and more heavy fighting in parts of what had once been the Soviet Union and the Middle East. It was all bad. What made up for it a little was the city of New York itself, not in the least like Trincomalee or even Colombo, and in fact not all that much like London. "It's so vertical," Ranjit told his wife as they stood at the 66th floor picture window of their hotel suite. "Who ever heard of sleeping this high up?" And yet in the panorama of the city that lay before them, there were a dozen or more buildings much taller, and when they walked in the city streets, there were times when the sun seldom appeared, because steep concrete walls shut it out, except when it was directly overhead. "But it does have that beautiful park," Myra pointed out, gazing at the lake, the giant apartments that lined the far side of the park and the distant roofs of the Central Park Zoo. "Oh, I'm not complaining," Ranjit told her, and indeed he had little to complain about. Though Dr. Dattusena Bandara's office in the UN building was just across town, the doctor himself was somewhere else, on some errand that no one chose to discuss. His office had, though, provided them with a young lady who had taken them to the top of the Empire State Building and introduced them to the Lucullan joys of oyster stew in the old Grand Central Railroad Station, and who stood ready to get tickets for them for any show on Broadway, which wasn't a great thrill to Ranjit, whose entire lifetime experience of performances had been on a flat screen, but greatly pleased Myra, which itself much pleased Ranjit, not to mention that he had discovered the American Museum of Natural History only a few blocks away, wonderful in its own right as an exemplar of that new delight in Ranjit's life, its museumness, but thrilling in the great planetarium that filled its northern space. Planetarium was hardly the right word, in fact. The structure on Central Park West was so much more than that. "I wish Yoris could be with us," Ranjit said, more than once, as he strolled its thrilling exhibits.
and then, following a long enough interval that Ranjit had stopped thinking he might actually show up, appeared the one person, totally unexpected, who could make a pleasant visit unforgettable. When Ranjit opened the door of their suite to unknock, supposing there would be no more than a chambermaid with an armload of fresh towels on the other side of it, there, in fact, grinning, stood Gamini Bandara, with a spray of fresh roses in one hand for Myra, and in the other a bottle of good old Sri Lanka arak for the two of them. It was the first time they had been together since the wedding, and the questions came thick and fast. How had they liked England? What did they think of America? What was it like back in Lanka these days? It wasn't until the men had poured their third round of arak that Myra noticed that all the conversation went in the same direction. Questions coming from Gamini, answers from her husband and herself. "So," she said at last, "tell us then, Gamini, what are you doing in New York?" He grinned and spread his hands. "One damn meeting after another, it's what I do." "But I thought you were based in California," Ranjit put in. "I am, right. But there's all sorts of international stuff going on, and this is where the UN is, isn't it?" Then he swallowed his third shot and looked serious. "Actually, the reason I'm here, Ranjit, is that I want to ask you to do me a favor." Ranjit said promptly, "Name it." "Don't say yes so fast," Gamini chided. "It means making a commitment for some time. But it's not a bad commitment either. So let me get right down to it. When you're in Washington, you will be contacted by a man named Orion Bledsoe. He's a cloak-and-dagger guy, and he's high up in the part of the government most people never hear about. For that matter, he has quite a record of his own. He is a veteran of the First Gulf War and of the troubles in what used to be Yugoslavia, and then of the second and much worse war in the Gulf, the one in Iraq. That's where he got, in that order, the wound that cost him his right arm, the Purple Heart, the Navy Cross, and, finally, the job he's got now." "Which is what?" Ranjit asked, as Gamini seemed to pause for a moment. Gamini shook his head. "Come on, Ranj. I'll have to let Bledsoe tell you that. There are rules I have to follow, you know." Ranjit tried again. "Is it going to be about a real job?" That made Gamini pause for thought again. "Well, yes, but I can't tell you what that is right now either," he said at last. "The important thing about that job is that you'll be doing something useful for the world. All we need Bledsoe for is to see that you get the security clearance you need." "Need for what?" Ranjit asked. Gamini, smiling, shook his head. Then, looking faintly embarrassed, he said, "I have to warn you that Bledsoe